to John Swinfield's Big Business Podcast. And now, let me introduce your host, journalist and writer, John Swinfield.
Hello, I'm John Swinfield. Welcome to Big Business. I'm a journalist and television producer, and I've spent much of my life writing and making films about business bosses. I hope you find this pod gossipy, irreverent, informative, and even fun. If you like the feed, please don't forget to click the subscriber button. Big Business is on every week at 11 a.m. GMT on Wednesdays. In this episode, I'm going to talk about Jerry Robinson, who became a formidable player in British television. I'll also be looking at the Disney Corporation in America, for decades a colossus in the world of global entertainment. Jerry Robinson moved to the front of the media queue when Britain's Granada Catering Company took over London Weekend Television. Sir Gerard Jude Jerry Robinson was born in Donegal in Ireland in 1948, the son of a village carpenter, the ninth of 10 children. One of his brothers drowned, age 14. Other siblings went into the building trade. One of them, Jerry told me, bought a fishing boat and a house in Ireland. I suspect he probably had a better time than any of us. A friend of mine, the late Father Paul Burns, an Irish missionary with the Oblates, devoted much of his life trying to reunite families who'd emigrated from Ireland. Jerry Robinson told me, yes, it's very sad. Many people have to leave Ireland to find fame and fortune elsewhere. Robinson and his wife today have a house in Donegal, close to where he was born. It's rather grander than his birthplace, a Georgian mansion with a lake and rolling acres. Jerry Robinson's business reputation was that of a determined operator. Was he, like my friend the missionary, a Roman Catholic? Yes, he told me, but not in a practicing way. Actually, I set out to be a priest. I went to a seminary in Lancashire. There is, in Ireland, of course, an enormous desire to please one's mother. But at the age of 16, I decided it simply wasn't for me. More than that, I felt that it wasn't real. And as a result, I'm now not really at all religious. The seminary largely gave me my education. There were strict education standards. Everybody came out with 4 good A-levels, and so did I. Robinson didn't go to university. No, he said, and it's one of my real regrets. My parents couldn't afford to go on funding me. With hindsight and with good A-levels, I could probably have got a grant. I went to the Youth Employment Office and, in a very naive way, took the first job that came along. It was in the cost office of Lesney Products, which made matchbox toys. He said the real attraction was the fact that the job offered a company car. It was a wonderful novel thing, he said, a mustard-coloured Mini. I remember it so clearly. Robinson climbed the corporate ladder with different companies, and eventually became the chief executive of Granada Catering in 1991. When it moved into TV and took over London Weekend Television, Robinson told me he didn't know what had hit him. All hell broke loose, and he was engulfed in controversy. Robinson told me, I was amazed how much publicity a TV station got. In catering, you're bloody lucky to get an article in the magazine Hotel and Caterer. Suddenly, from my peaceful world in catering, I was thrown into the media, which was horrendous. The biggest row came when he ousted David Plowright. Plowright had been with Granada 35 years. His acrimonious departure led to protests from every quarter. Robinson's critics included the playwright Harold Pinter, and the comedian and satirist and star of Monty Python, John Cleese. John Cleese sent a letter to Robinson asking what he knew about television and calling him an upstart caterer who should F off back to the kitchen. I was very sad about all that, Robinson told me. It became absolutely clear that there was no way David Plowright had any intention of working for somebody who came in from outside the industry. He was fairly dismissive of a new broom. I had sympathy with him. I think I would have felt the same. It ended with David going, and then we had this enormous caterer accountant furore, with me being seen as almost single-handedly destroying British broadcasting. I was astonished. Robinson had enjoyed great success in catering, but he was seen as ignorant about television. David Plowright was a revered figure in Granada and a highly respected programme maker. Robinson's incursion was seen as a major blow for programme producers and a start point for the ascendancy of accountants, suits and the money men in TV. And what of the intervention by John Cleese? Robinson told me, "Well, I replied to John saying, reading carefully between the lines of your letter," and he said with a smile, it was of course a one-line letter, "I can clearly see I am a bigger fan of you than you are of me." We got together and we had a chat. He was sincere about his worries, and I got to know him reasonably well. I like him. Quite a good relationship developed out of that. I think he's a very sensitive, sincere guy who just misread the situation. I was deeply affected by what had happened at Granada, and very put out and very hurt by the publicity at the time. Robinson was branded ruthless, an opportunist and an asset stripper. Was he proud, I asked him, of his commercial success? Well, it sort of happened, you know, rather than being planned. I'm pleased to have got to where I have, but, well, proud, no, proud wouldn't be the right word. Did he enjoy the power? You know, people hugely overemphasize this, he said. There's an assumption that someone who runs Granada Television writes the next episode of Coronation Street. The truth is that running Granada does not involve having that day-to-day influence on television. He later presented TV shows, some of which saw him offering advice to struggling businesses. At one time, he prowled hospital corridors with a prescription for curing the myriad ills of the National Health Service. Running a business, he told me, is not something that is hugely intellectual. It's about straightforward clarity. It's seeing what matters in a very clear way and having people follow that clarity. It's really, when you think about it, well, it's as simple as that. With a massive business like Granada and ITV, it isn't simple, of course. But Robinson, the man who chose profit over priesthood, with his Irish charm, ready smile, and winning blue eyes, was one of those in big business who could make anything sound plausible. And now to something quite different, but still in the entertainment game, the Disney Corporation. When I made an ITV half-hour documentary in America about the international media player, the Disney Company, I was greeted by Card Walker, its boss. At the moment of my arrival, he had to take a phone call. There is in my mind a picture of him, the chief of this multi-billion dollar corporation, talking exceedingly big bucks on a Mickey Mouse phone, which stood in the hall of his home, with its outsized ears, black smudged nose, and somewhat cheeky and impudent face, one of cinema's best-loved characters, the Disney motif familiar across the globe. "We all love Mickey," Card drawled. "The mouse done good. He makes a good phone, too." Walt Disney, the founder of the company, was that rare mix of superlative creativity and phenomenally successful businessman. Animator, filmmaker, entrepreneur, audiences in their millions have been enchanted by Disney's movies from the earliest days of cinema. Among them, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, 1937, Pinocchio from 1940, Cinderella 1950, and Mary Poppins 1964. There are 1,000 more titles. I happen to be a Disney Imagineer, an honorary title bestowed on me by Card, of which I am insanely proud. It fascinated me that Walt Disney built almost as big a reputation in theme parks as he did in movies. The company employs a squadron of Imagineers, whose job, in essence, is to dream up new ideas and make them work, the last bit being the tricky part. Epcot is a theme park in Orlando, Florida. It opened in 1982. Card Walker, naturally enough, dismissed my somewhat curmudgeonly suggestion that the parks, now strung across the world, including China, were just glorified funfairs, though he nodded along with the notion that theme park was perhaps a misnomer, given the technology, ambition, their immensity and complexity, and the sheer welter of imagination poured into them. Epcot Center itself is a geodesic sphere resembling a giant silver golf ball known as Spaceship Earth. It brims with wizardry and animatronics, the wondrous stuff with which Disney is synonymous. It's far removed, however, from Walt's original idea of a planned technological city. Epcot means experimental prototype community of tomorrow. That's quite a mouthful. An executive told me it would have been a utopian paradise. To me, it sounded dystopian. It was jettisoned after Walt's death in 1966, judged as being unrealistic and too costly. There were suggestions from some that its citizens would have been pried on by cameras, a city of surveillance, as if they were specimens in a bell jar. Disney is a giant among giants in global entertainment. Operating out of Burbank in California, it has more than 220,000 workers. Its assets include film, studios, theatres, cruise ships, books, publishing, all sorts of things. A myriad of brands such as Marvel, Pixar, X-Men and Star Wars. Its empire includes merchandise, stores and TV stations ABC and the sport channel ESPN. In 2019, it paid a whopping $71 billion for Fox's entertainment assets. Its back catalogue and intellectual property rights are worth billions. Walt always maintained that his older brother, Roy, the co-founder of the company, was the real Disney. When Walt died, the business hit a difficult patch and survived a number of takeover bids. The shareholders, Roy, and the Texas-born Sid Bass, fought back, bringing in Michael Eisner from Paramount Pictures. Down the decades, there have been creative, financial and boardroom tussles, but Disney remains a formidable player amid the colossi with which it now competes. Its competitors include Comcast, DreamWorks, NBC Universal, CBS, Netflix, and Japan's Nintendo, one of the biggest names in video games. For Disney to be a dominant player for so long in a highly capricious sector with newer companies such as Netflix is an achievement in itself. Disney was never content to rely on heritage. It always tried, unsuccessfully sometimes, to be in the vanguard of the creative and technological tsunami which has swept the industry. Michael Eisner was one of those who progressed and safeguarded Disney. For more than 20 years, he was its chief executive, starting in 1984. 2 years after becoming the Disney boss, he presented a TV series, The Wonderful World of Disney, a smart marketing ploy which gave Disney a reassuring face, a personality which had been lacking since Walt Disney's death. He revamped the company with new theme parks and films. In a business of such scale and history, it's inevitable that pressures grow both within and without. In 2003, Roy E. Disney, the son and the nephew of the founders Walt and Roy, quit as the chairman of Disney's feature animation division. It was a fraught period. Eisner resigned in 2005. He was succeeded by Bob Iger, formerly of ABC Television. Disney went on a spending spree, buying Pixar, the animation studios, Marvel Entertainment, 21st Century Fox, and Lucasfilm, founded by George Lucas, the creator of Indiana Jones and Star Wars. The pandemic, of course, took its toll on Disney, but like Popeye, it's always managed to fight back. As in life, in business, things move on. Iger's now been succeeded as the chief executive by Bob Chapek, who's been 26 years with Disney. To run the world's most famous mouse house, he has to fill shoes as big as Mickey's and those of his managerial predecessors. Disney's history reads like one of its own fables. An impoverished, tiny business born in a cartoon studio in 1923. It beats overwhelming odds to become a colossus. But new giants now jostle for space on the stage it once commanded. If the Disney fairy tale is to have a happy ending, the company will need to be as deft at slaying the new predators as its celluloid heroes were in the past. You've been listening to Big Business. This is John Swinfield signing off. Don't forget to click on subscribe. I'm on every Wednesday at 11 a.m. GMT.